business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, Quentin Myers, John Mayer, and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please.
Good morning.
May it please the court. Cooperative federalism is the cornerstone of the Clean Air Act. Both the Supreme Court and this court have held that the Act's core structure requires EPA to set the standards, then give the states a chance to meet those standards. But EPA failed to do that here.
Well, the standards that they're referring to in the statute are the National Ambient Air Quality Standards.
The standards that we're referring to here, the standard is the definition of significant contribution. That's what the states and interfere with maintenance in the good neighbor provision.
But we're looking at the plain text of the statute, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And we would point the court to section 110K5 of the Clean Air Act, which is the SIP call provision.
All right, but we're starting out where you started out, namely cooperative federalism, and the statute says that EPA is to set the national ambient air quality standards, and then the states have an obligation to come up with these plans to meet those standards.
That's correct, Your Honor. And there is nothing in the statute that requires EPA to set the definition of significant contribution or interfere with maintenance. But EPA has taken that task upon itself to do that in the first instance before states can know what they're shooting at. EPA sets the goals, the states set the particular means of achieving those goals.
Let me ask you, why do you say before the states know? I was reading EPA's notice of disapproval, for example, of the CARE SIP plan from North Carolina, and it points out that, you know, this information is public information available to the states, and the states do their own meteorological studies, and then EPA examines them to determine whether or not those studies are adequate or not. So that's all before. In other words, I'm not clear why you say the states can't know what to do.
Well, that may be true for states that are excluded from the region-wide program. They can submit a SIP to try to meet the standard, and EPA can look at it and say, yes, that's fine. But for states that are included within the present rule, which I'll call CASPER, that's not true, because CASPER simultaneously set the standard to be met and issued federal implementation plans saying the states had failed to meet that standard.
But that's only after the states had failed to submit plans that EPA had approved within that three-year period set by the statute.
Well, all of those, there are approvals, there are disapprovals here, there are findings of failure that EPA has come out with. But the bottom line for all of them is they are judged by a standard that did not yet exist at the time of those actions. The standard was first promulgated in CASPER itself.
Well, Congress contemplated that the standard was set when the ambient air standard was announced by EPA. And then EPA puts out all this guidance and assists to the states, et cetera. But that the states, says Congress, would have 3 years to come up with these plans.
And Your Honor is referring to section 110A1, and that's correct. And if NAAQS were the only thing that the states had to achieve, that might be true, but it's not. The states have to meet EPA's own definition of significant contribution. And it's instructive to see what EPA did in the past two transport rules.
But could I just be clear about this? If a state on its own under 110 A were to submit a plan to EPA, and EPA decided this was fine, that would be the end of the matter, wouldn't it?
That's correct. If EPA says that, if EPA agrees with the state's analysis that there's no significant contribution, and the state happened to guess right, but...
No, but my point is, it isn't a question of guess here. In other words, EPA has put out this rule, which I'm referring to as the transport rule, just for ease of reference, and it says this is one way you can do it. You know, but states are free to come up with other ways to meet the NAAQS standards.
The states that were issued FIPS don't have that liberty. They are stuck with the federal implementation plans that EPA has required them to comply with starting the first of this year if the stay had not come in.
All right. So under C2, Congress gave, and here I just think I'm just talking plain language here. This is an interpretation. It says that the administrator, if, you know, the state hasn't come up with, either hasn't submitted a plan or EPA disapproves the plan, then Congress gave the EPA administrator the authority to issue a FIP unless the states came up, you know, with an approved plan within that 2-year period before the FIP was issued.
And Judge Rogers, I believe you're talking about C1.
No, I'm into C2, the FIP.
C1 is the provision that gives EPA FIP authority.
C1, excuse me. That's
okay. C1 doesn't apply here because C1 talks about a required submission. That's in C1A. And there can be no required submission to meet a standard that does not yet exist. And I would point the court to what EPA said in the NOx SIP call. This is the first of these three transport rules. Mm-hmm. It explained that neither the statute nor its legislative history provides any meaningful guidance on what contribute significantly means in this statute. It explained that determining the level of emissions under the Good Neighbor provision is, quote, comparable to determining overall standards of air quality. That is comparable to determining NAAQS. And so until EPA does that, it has no FIP authority. The states have to have a chance to issue a SIP to meet that.
Mr. Davis, if we were in a law school class under statutory interpretation class, your argument would be what people often call a functional analysis, isn't it? Judge Rogers started us off, I think, correctly with the plain text argument. You don't have a strong plain text argument, do you? You have a functional analysis saying the way this statute is supposed to work, there are federalism concerns involved, and therefore that ought to help us understand what takes place here. Isn't that right?
That's right, Your Honor. The entire structure of the Clean Air Act and the provisions at issue here support the cooperative federalism model that this court walked through in Virginia versus EPA Part 2C.
The plain text reading perhaps does not. That poses some problems to you.
It does only because there's no plain text provision requiring EPA to define significant contribution. But once it's taken that task upon itself and expressly analogized that to setting NAAQS, it is recognized in the past.
The text doesn't address the question, is what I heard you saying, not that the text, that you're trying to get around the text.
That's right. The text doesn't address this precise question, but...
What's the precise question you have in mind? The precise question I had in mind is the relationship between the FIPS and the SIPs, right? As I understand your argument here, you say that there's you haven't been afforded, the states haven't been afforded the opportunity to respond to this proposal from the APA. In fact, it's not a proposal. It's now law. Is that the argument?
That's right. This to talk about the law school example. This would be like having a law school exam, and the professor hands out the test, and there are a bunch of questions on the test, and there's also a grade at the top, and that grade is an F, and the student never had a chance to answer any of the questions. That's what happened.
That's like if the test was there probable cause to arrest? All right. You know, and then the Supreme Court comes out later and says, you know, you got it wrong. But you can answer the question initially, And the statute, that's what I'm trying to understand, what Congress had in mind when it says to the states that your plan shall contain adequate provisions on this good neighbor provision.
States do have that obligation, but when EPA, through the process of complex rulemaking, takes it upon itself to define what significant contribution means, states can't have a fair shot at meeting that obligation until they know what the goal is they're aiming towards.
Perhaps I'm misunderstanding something. I may very well be. You keep coming back to this notion that somehow EPA did something inappropriate when it took upon itself to define significant contribution. Isn't that exactly what they're supposed to do?
No, Your Honor, we're not saying that's inappropriate. We're saying that having done that, EPA has to allow the Clean Air Act to work as intended. That is, having taken upon itself to define that term, it has to let the states know what that definition is and try to meet it through SIPs before the FIPs are imposed. And on, I want to point the court, if I could, to a passage in CARE. This is not in the joint appendix, but it appears at 70 Federal Register 25263-64 and 25268-69.
25364?
25263-64. And then again at pages 68 to 69 in that same range. That's the passage where EPA talks in CARE about what it's doing here. And it's saying we recognize that we have to give the states some amount of time to meet this standard that we're coming down with. Because it's analogous to a NAAQS. The states have to have a chance.
But in CARE, they issued a FIP.
They issued FIPs, but they made sure that the timing of those FIPs allowed for the SIPs that states could submit to meet that new standard would be effective. And only if those SIPs didn't work would the FIPs kick in.
So even though the states have access to information about what the emissions flow is in terms of amounts, and through meteorological studies can determine where it's going and which states it's affecting, they have no obligation under the statute come up with a SIP plan and submit it to EPA, but rather the states, which are arguing here, as I understand it, that Congress intended the states to be the primary actors here once EPA set the NAAQS standard, that states can't do anything, but they have to wait for EPA to tell them what the significant contribution standard is.
That's right, and it goes to the premise of your question, that states could have all the information and run the models to know what their significant contribution is. That's not true.
Well, but I just referenced EPA's disapproval of North Carolina's SIP, for example, where EPA sets out that the states do have all this information, that they can run their own models and figure out what it is. And well, they can have a discussion with EPA as to whether what they've done is appropriate or not. But I don't see where either the statute contemplated that the states had to wait for EPA or that EPA has said in these rules that this is the only way a state can meet its obligation under 110A.
It's the only way that the states can meet the test that EPA has defined. Now, the states might come up with their own modeling, but as I said before, it would just be a guess at what EPA would ultimately come up with. And in order to avoid the FIP, the states would need to have all that information from EPA to know what the goal is they had to meet in a SIP.
So is it your argument, to use the language of statutory interpretation cases, that it would be absurd to require states to do SIPs before they know what the significant contribution definition is from EPA?
Yes. If it's absurd, or at the very least, it's directly contrary to the structure of the Act, which is premised on the idea that states get to do the SIP first. The cooperative federalism that the court discussed in Virginia versus EPA just can't function without that step. And the passage that I pointed to from CARE reflects that.
Well, let me go back to some more plain language for a moment. You want us to focus on K-5.
That's correct.
But K-5 talks about a finding that a SIP plan that has been submitted is inadequate, and therefore the state has to be given more time. Here, at least as to the 2006 24-hour PM NAC standard, EPA either found that certain states had failed to submit a SIP as to this NAC, or it disapproved the SIP the states had submitted, and therefore EPA argues under C2, am I right now?
C1, Your Honor.
Under C1, where it says the administrator shall promulgate a FIP any time within 2 years after the administrator makes either of those findings, so that the states under this statutory scheme still have a two-year period before, well, if EPA has found they haven't submitted anything, or they have submitted something and the administrator has disapproved it, then the statute gives the states 2 more years to come up with a SIP that the administrator will approve before EPA can issue a FIP.
Well, that's not how EPA is reading that provision. The two-year period in C1 hasn't yet run for any of the disapprovals or the findings of failure that Your Honor's talking about.
Well, it depends whether you read the statute the way EPA is reading it. At least, for example, as to the 2006 24-hour PM standard, EPA says we put the standard out in 2010, and you know, now, am I right about that? They put it out in 2006, excuse me. And the administrator has now found in 2011 that these states either didn't submit a SIP or the SIP they submitted, the administrator has disapproved.
Right.
So my only point is that if we adopt your language, do we have to essentially rewrite subsection C1?
No. The answer to this question is reading the statute as a whole and recognizing that SIPs have to come before FIPs, and that comes from the very definition of what a FIP is. And in terms of the two-year period, what EPA has said is, well, that two-year FIP window of our authority has begun, and so we can simultaneously define the standard and issue FIPs. But the states, it hasn't given a chance for the states within that two-year period to come out with SIPs.
But Congress amended the statute because it was frustrated by the fact that the states weren't taking action, and it was also frustrated by the fact that EPA wasn't taking action. So it added these provisions that said very clearly that the states have the first opportunity and responsibility, and the administrator is sort of this backstop that says if you don't do it within a certain period of time, then we're going to either disapprove or say make a finding that you haven't submitted it, and we're going to give you another 2 years, but after that, EPA says Congress can issue a FIP.
I would agree with all of that, Your Honor. The problem is EPA has to say what the standard is before any of that can happen. And if
I know that's your interpretation, but why would it be, you said it wasn't absurd results, but you said directly contrary to the structure. Why is it absurd when EPA puts out a rule that says, here's one way to do it, but it doesn't say this is the only way, and states can come up with their own ways? I mean, my extreme hypothetical would be an upwind state sees its emissions are causing problems, and so it shuts down all its sources. I mean, that's obviously an extreme example. It's not going to happen, but it's not impossible, is my point. And within those two extremes, there's a lot of room for the states to act. And states have acted. That's my point.
But the states have been bound by the CASPER FIPS before having a chance to figure out how to meet the obligations in a way, for instance, that preserves reliability of electrical supply.
So Congress was clearly wrong in concluding that states would have the capability, once they knew what the NAC standard was, to come up with a SIP plan that addressed a state's good neighbor obligation?
I wouldn't say Congress was wrong. I just don't think it contemplated this scenario in which EPA is not defining the standard through the NAAQS, but rather through a separate step. I want to point quickly to one other provision. It's the next provision after K5, 110K6. EPA has used this in an extreme manner. It addresses corrections to past actions. And what EPA has said is that it's essentially a vehicle for changing past actions.
What do you think that section authorizes EPA to do?
It authorizes EPA to make ministerial corrections to past actions and
typographical errors, that sort of thing.
Yes, something along those lines, or at the very least, errors that were errors at the time made, not errors that became errors when a new legal standard came out. I see my time is running short. I'd like to say a few words on significant contribution and just make 2 points. First is CSAPR, or the transport rule, is internally inconsistent. And second, it doesn't regulate in the state-by-state manner that North Carolina required. So on the first point, there were two steps to EPA's significance analysis. The first was to set a line at 1% of the NAAQS, below which contributions are insignificant. And then step two was to completely ignore that line and redefine significance or insignificance as based entirely on cost.
So what does this court do with its opinion in Michigan?
Michigan
that approved this type of double definition of significant contribution.
The only question in Michigan was whether EPA could permissibly take cost into consideration when setting significant contribution. So we don't contest that. But what we do say is that it can't take cost into consideration in a way that drives any state down below the point at which, under step one of its analysis, EPA said is insignificant. It can't.
So the court would have to hold that what? It was not a matter of authorization or simply arbitrary and capricious to say we're going to define significance for purposes of coverage with a 1% threshold, but in terms of the state's obligation to address its significant contribution, we're not going to refer to that threshold, essentially because the court in Michigan told us we could do it.
It would be both arbitrary, capricious, and in excess of its statutory authority, because the good neighbor provision talks about prohibiting sources within the state from emitting any air pollutant in amounts which will significantly contribute.
I couldn't find that this argument was raised before the EPA in the comments at all.
It was raised by two states, Tennessee and Wisconsin.
But was it a statutory argument they were making, or was it a policy argument? The way I read it, they were talking about, you know, what good policy would be, but I haven't been able to find that the statutory argument you're making right now was raised below.
It maybe wasn't in the precise language that we've expressed today.
Well, it definitely wasn't in the precise language you tested, and it was, again, I can't even find a statutory argument being made. That's a significant problem for you, isn't it?
Well, we believe those comments sufficiently teed up the issue. They alerted EPA to the problem that the statute talks about significant contribution and it needed to look at actual amounts of upwind contribution, and it failed to do that. And that properly put the issue before the agency.
Well, I guess the statutory standard is a little stricter than that, isn't it? And since in North Carolina, the court repeated what it had said in Michigan as an appropriate way to proceed, that if somebody's going to raise it, they better be very clear to EPA that you can't follow either North Carolina or Michigan.
Well, in North Carolina, the court stressed that individual upwind contributions do matter, and EPA needed to perform its analysis with respect to those upwind contributions. And here instead, EPA has just looked at downwind results, and it hasn't even generated the information to know whether any upwind state has been driven into the de minimis range that is the insignificant range. And that is something that the use of uniform cost curves can certainly do. Uniform cost curves can not only regulate above that 1%, but they can also regulate insignificant contributions.
Okay. Anything further?
No.
We'll give you a couple of minutes. And
thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'd like to begin, if I may, by picking up on Mr. Davis's argument on significant contribution and then address some of the other arguments in our brief. And I'd like to both lay out the problem that we see with the agency's treatment of this issue and also explain where it was raised and passed on below Judge Griffith and the import Judge Rogers of Michigan. First of all, in terms of the problem, we think it is both a statutory problem and an arbitrary and capricious problem. The statute here only authorizes the agency to prohibit an amount of an individual state's emissions that make a significant contribution to non-attainment or maintenance problems in downward areas. And here, as Mr. Davis said, the EPA determined that any state that contributes less than 1% of the NACs to downwind areas, in the EPA's words, does not significantly.
Haven't we already crossed that bridge in Michigan?
No, Your Honor. Michigan never addressed or considered this issue. First of all, because the NOx SIP call, which is the rulemaking that was at issue here, didn't present it in the same way. There was no 1% or any bright line threshold used to screen out states in the NOx SIP call. What the agency did there was in the analog to step one, they had a holistic weight of the evidence analysis. We're going to look at 9 factors and 3 metrics under 2 models and decide on balance who significantly contributes. So there was no way to say there that EPA had to find a zone of insignificance in step one and then push states down into it in step two because they hadn't defined that zone. And that's why Michigan never endorsed what the EPA says here. Michigan never endorsed the idea that you could use cost to drive a state below the level of significance. Michigan's holding was that cost...
Excuse me, go ahead.
Michigan's holding was that cost can be a factor. Every time it formulated the question, it was, does the statute preclude any consideration of cost, or does it require a one-dimensional inquiry on the basis of health? And it said cost can be a factor. And in particular, what it said is there's a background principle with which we interpret statutes that agencies aren't expected to impose costs that are excessive when there are little or no incremental benefits. That's not saying that you can use cost as a sword to push states below the significant contribution level that the statute establishes and that EPA's own methodology defines at 1%.
Michigan. So when we understood Michigan to allow EPA to define this ambiguous term in two ways. One is a coverage issue, and then secondly as an emissions issue. That was incorrect?
No, it's that it wasn't presented in this way because the court never said, because the agency never had a methodology which indicated that it was doing this, that you could in that second step push the state below the level that the agency itself has determined demarcates a level below which contributions are insignificant. All we're really saying here, and it wasn't presented in the NOx SIP call Michigan issue the way it is here, is that having drawn that line for some states, they can't then push other states below that line when they have a statute which says you can only prohibit the amount of emissions that make a significant contribution.
Well, let me ask you, part of EPA's response, as I understand it, and I may be incorrect, is that the way its rule works is there is no state that is being, states are connected in a significant way to at least one monitor, and then maybe in some insignificant ways to other monitors. But that's how it's defined in terms of A, whether the state is covered, and then in terms of the state's obligation to eliminate that significant contribution, you can't, one of the briefs says you can't land on a dime here. There is going to be some give and take, and at least whether it was the direct holding or not, in Michigan, the court appeared to acknowledge that was likely to happen?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, the stop on a dime point I do want to address, and I will get to that in a moment. But certainly it is the case that individual upwind states are linked to multiple downwind states, and they may have an impact above 1% on one and less than 1% on the other. Our point is simply is that the EPA can't say, let's say North Carolina doesn't make a contribution above 1% to any state, and therefore it's out of the program, it can't be regulated, the amount and impact of its emissions are too small to be subject to regulation under this provision. But South Carolina can be driven to a point where it is not contributing more than 1% to any downwind state, where it is driven below that for every downwind state. And their methodology doesn't prevent that. They didn't look at it. They never determined whether they were honoring the 1% threshold when they set the amounts of the budgets. And we say that contravenes both their statutory authority and is arbitrary and
capricious. Can I just be clear? You're saying that EPA could not have a two-part definition to significant contribution?
No, Your Honor, we're not saying that. We're just saying they have to honor the premises of their first part when they get to the second part. Because if in their first part they are saying this amount of a contribution from an upwind state is too small to subject it to regulation, then it can't take another state and say we're going to drive you below that level so that you are emitting emissions that are even smaller in their amount and impact that led us to screen out the first state. That would be true even if there were no case law, if you were just looking at the statute, which limits them to significant contributions and their own definitions of significance.
Could EPA, in your view, redo exactly what it did in Michigan?
I think at this point, having found that contributions below 1% are not significant, to then do some other analysis which ignores the fact that they've created the zone in a subsequent rulemaking, I think would be arbitrary and capricious. And if they were doing that in response to an adverse ruling here, I think we would say they were trying to circumvent the court's ruling. I'd like to turn, if I could, to the stop on a dime issue, Judge Rogers, because that relates to the other independent respect in which we think the agency has violated the statute here, which is that in addition to limiting its authority to be able to regulate only significant contributions, it also limits its authority to regulate to achieve anything beyond attainment or maintenance. And we've shown that the results here go way beyond simply achieving attainment and maintenance in downwind states. They've achieved substantially better than attainment and maintenance. And their response, Your Honor, is, Judge Rogers, what you said, which is, look, this is a complicated endeavor. You can't expect us to be so precise and so finely calibrated in our regulation that every downwind area just stops at a dime right on the NAAQS. And we agree with that. But they also say that we didn't present them with any means to better tailor their regulation and make sure they weren't regulating beyond that level, and that's just wrong. Because what we said,
what they said is that where a party came forward, not even a party, but just somebody before the agency came forward with the data, they took that into account.
They didn't, Your Honor. Because our point here is that the way to determine whether they are over-regulating, the way to determine whether they have mandated more emissions reductions than are necessary to satisfy the statutory goal of attainment is to look at cost thresholds below $500 a ton. This is a very important argument for us. It's made in Section 3A of our brief. The EPA barely addresses it in its response. They required emissions reductions of everything up to $500 a ton. But they never looked at whether satisfactory results under this statute in downwind areas could have been achieved at $400 a ton.
Well, let me ask you so I'm clear, and I was going to ask EPA this too. Under this rule, if I'm a state and I have emissions that are significantly contributing, say, equal to the number 500, or let's do 400 just so we have different numbers, if I can figure out a way as a state to get rid of that 400 without using cost reduction technology that costs $500, there's nothing to prohibit me from doing it.
No, that's right. But they have defined the amount of the reductions that are required of you
right. By
applying that cost threshold. And
why doesn't Michigan allow that, at least?
That wasn't addressed at all in Michigan. And the point we're making here is, again, both a statutory and an arbitrary capricious arguments. We had commenters that showed that if you regulated at thresholds below $500 a ton, you'd get the same or virtually the same results of air quality in downwind states. And if they had looked at $400 a ton and found that these downwind areas were still in attainment or maintenance problems were being dealt with, then they had no authority to regulate at $500 a ton, because even though states, Your Honor, can perhaps find other ways to reduce the same amounts, the reality is that the higher the cost threshold, the more states are being required to spend and the more they're required to reduce. And if they had looked at $400 or $300 a ton and found that the downwind areas were still in attainment, then they were required to regulate at $400 or $300 a ton. And if they had found that only some of the downwind areas were in attainment at $400 or $300, they would at least have to regulate those upwind states that are linked only to that subset of downwind states at $400 or $300 a ton.
So you say that the court has to reject EPA's analysis and their curve that shows, you know, what the impact is of certain cost level control technologies?
Yes, because they stopped that curve at an arbitrary point.
Well, they say it wasn't arbitrary. They say it's at that point that you could see change.
But
that would lead to reductions.
Yeah, they say that as they go up the curve, that's the best point. But they never analyzed whether they could achieve the same results at less regulation and lower cost thresholds.
Let me ask you, you're saying that they never did that state by state.
They never did that at all.
At one point, I thought your brief was saying they had to do it each EGU by EGU. But
no.
But are you saying here they, in your view, they had to do it? Well, even though North Carolina said EPA's regional analysis wasn't sufficiently state specific, you're saying that EPA had not only to measure the significant contribution, but then on the back end, if I can put it that way, in setting the state's budget, it had to look state by state at cost threshold?
For purposes of this, we're not saying they can't use a uniform cost threshold.
Right.
What we're saying is they looked at $500 a ton and said, what does that produce? They looked at $1,000 a ton and said, what does that produce? And they kept on going up and saying, what downwind air quality does that produce? But they never went below $500 a ton. You can't know if you are over-regulating, particularly with results like these, which are so much better than attainment, unless you at least ask the question, would lower cost thresholds have produced the same results? We had commenters who showed they would. The EPA just ignored that analysis completely. That was arbitrary, and it failed to honor their statutory obligation to regulate only to the point that they need to in order to address attainment and maintenance problems.
They didn't analyze it, presumably, because they didn't think they needed to only go right to the precise point of attainment.
Well, I'm not sure that's right, Your Honor. They don't dispute that attainment is a statutory limitation on their power to regulate. I think, you know, they say that naturally you're going to go somewhat beyond. There's going to be some spillover, and we agree with that.
Right.
But the question is this extraordinary excess beyond attainment just that inevitable spillover? Or is it that the fact that they took a $500 a ton threshold when they should have done a lower cost threshold? They can't know and they can't answer.
How far should they have gone below 500?
Until they start reaching a point where the results are bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 400, 300, they get to 300 and they say the downwind air quality is now unacceptable. We don't need to go below 300.
But you have to say they didn't respond. They did respond. You may disagree. But they say there may be attainment, but there's going to be maintenance problem in some of these very close areas, et cetera, so that what you're proposing wouldn't achieve.
No, Your Honor, they did not say that. They never said if we went below $500 a ton, there would be attainment problems. That's the problem. If they had looked at $400 a ton and said there would be attainment.
Well, EPA, but I thought they had looked at 400, at least for one of the NACs.
No, in the proposed rule, they had data at $100 a ton for SO2. But then in the final rule, they say we did not examine cost thresholds below $500 a ton. And we did make this point, and, you know, they responded with nothing. They didn't explain why they didn't look at lower cost thresholds. They acknowledged that they didn't look at lower cost thresholds. And we think that is both arbitrary and capricious and a violation of the statute. And if I could move to another of our points.
Just one other issue that you can address. You had an argument in your brief that there was a problem as well because the rule doesn't take account of local controls in the states. Do you want to address that?
The point is that the statute gives the local area, the state within which the NAAQS as being attained, the primary responsibility for achieving the NAAQS. This is a supplemental provision, which is designed to assist those states in achieving the NAAQS. And our position is that they've sort of reversed it. They first asked the question, are we regulating the upwind states enough to achieve attainment? And we think there should be more emphasis on local controls. And whenever, for example, they require us to go below the 1% and the significant contribution, they are necessarily requiring us to assume some of the burden of air quality improvement that really belongs in the downwind state that is primarily responsible for its NAAQS.
How would they do that?
Well, with respect to the 1%, they would simply do...
How would they take account of local controls in this kind of rule?
Well, they are aware of the local controls that they are imposing. I think it ultimately, Your Honor, it's not actually an independent, separate statutory argument. It is more a further reason why it's important for them to honor the definition of significant contribution, because when they go beyond that, they are forcing the upwind states to shoulder the burden that properly belongs in the downwind state.
Of course, their response is that the downwind states have their plans as well, and EPA has either approved them or disapproved them or found them inadequate or whatever. But, I mean, it's not as though the downwind states are free of any obligations under the statute.
That's right.
And they have plans consistent with the statute.
And that's right. And our only point is that insofar as they require upwind states to reduce by more than their significant contribution, they are requiring the upwind states to do more than the distribution of responsibility should require under the statute. Another point that I would like to...
So just so I'm clear, you say you agree that this is not a precise and there will be some overlap. Where is it? How much is it? How much is permissible?
We think the limitations are, first, that they can't force states to go below the 1%, and second, they have to at least look at lower cost thresholds to make sure they're not forcing upwind states to reduce their emissions that go to the extent that go beyond the level necessary to achieve attainment or deal with maintenance problems in the downwind areas. We also believe that this rule is arbitrary because it rests entirely on air quality projections that are demonstrably and pervasively wrong, and by a wide margin, when compared with the real-world data that the agency itself generated and then ignored. And I'd like to just be very...
EPA had a response to that, and they explained that they were responding to our decision in North Carolina that says you have to start all over again. So they said we're looking at air without regard to any reductions that may occur under CARE.
Yes.
And they respond to your proffer of real air, saying that's with the CARE reductions in it.
That is exactly what they say, Your Honor, and it's a non sequitur. And let me be very concrete about what our claim is and why that response is no response at all. Our point is that a majority of the receptors, the downwind receptors, that their projections say will be in non-attainment, are in fact in attainment today under CARE. And the whole thrust of this rule is that deeper reductions, deeper than CARE, are somehow required for those areas to be in attainment. That can't be right. They do say, Your Honor, that, well, they had to back CARE out. They had to do an analysis of future air quality that doesn't take into account CARE because the court said CARE has to be replaced. And we agree with that. The question here is, when they did those projections of what air quality would look like after CARE, are those projections any good? Do they make any sense? And we say they don't make any sense because you can benchmark them against the real-world data that was generated under CARE. And if you find, as you do for a host of sites, that air quality under CASPER, the transport rule, is going to be poorer than it is today under CARE after CASPER makes deeper emission cuts than CARE has made, then something is very badly out of whack. Then your projections can't be right. If they're projecting that air quality goes down when emissions cuts get deeper, which is what their projections say, then something is wrong, and you have to take a step back and say our projections are wrong. And, Your Honors, they concede on page 79, note 43 of their brief, that what I've just said is true for 44% of the downwind sites, that their projections say the air quality will be worse under CASPER, despite deeper cuts, than it is today under CARE. If 44% of the sites have data that's so clearly wrong, projections that are so clearly wrong. Certainly none of the upwind states that are linked to those downwind states can be regulated on that basis. And that means that the whole set of projections that they're using flows from some very, very bad assumptions.
They do have a response to that, but in any event.
Well, I mean, they do concede. And the other point I would make, the final point I would make on this particular issue, is that even if you take their air quality projections as exactly right, even though the real-world data shows that they project far poorer air quality than is possible, even under their air projections, they are projecting that in 2014, host of areas will be in attainment without care and without CASPER. And yet they have regulated massively a series of upwind states as contributing in 2014 to those states. There are 2014 budgets that require upwind states to massively reduce their emissions, even though EPA's own air quality projections, which we dispute because they're worse than they should be, but those own air quality projections say that these downwind areas will be in attainment without CARE or CASPER. And again, they concede this on page 84, note 48 of their brief.
And that would knock some states out of it entirely.
That would make a lot of states out of it, Judge Kavanaugh.
A lot? I didn't think it was.
Well, they said on page 84, note 48, that 43% of the downwind areas they have projected will be in attainment even without CARE and without CASPER in 2014. And if that's true, they have no authority under the statute to require massive reductions from upwind states that are linked to those downwind states. And their one answer to this is to say on page 83 of their brief that we misapprehend their decision-making process. They didn't look, they say, at those numbers for the 2014 base case that showed what these downwind locations would look like without CARE and without CASPER. And our point is we understood that process. We said they have to look at that, and they didn't. And if, with the Court's permission, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Yes, thank you.
May it please the Court, my name is Jack Lipschultz from the Justice Department. With me today at council table are Norman Raven, David Galtieri from the Justice Department, and Sonia Rodman and Stephanie Hogan from EPA's Office of General Counsel.
All right, so you're going to address significant contribution issues.
I am, yes. Just for the purposes of orderliness, would you like me to go through what the other?
No, get right to it.
Got you. Okay, well, just to get right to the chase, I think I'd like to respond to some of the issues that the petitioner is focused on with regard to significant contribution. A good portion of their challenge is based on this argument concerning the 1% thresholds, and there's a few serious misconceptions and misrepresentations there that I think need to be corrected. First of all, the analytical construct used in this rule in this respect is identical to Michigan.
I just don't think that's right. In Michigan, the idea was that you're allowed to use costs. But the argument was never raised in Michigan, not in the brief. I've looked at the briefs in Michigan and the opinion in Michigan. It was not raised that you can't force a state to reduce emissions by more than its own significant contribution to downwind non-attainment. That argument was not raised. And then North Carolina comes along and specifically says, and repeatedly, EPA may not require some states to exceed the mark. EPA has no authority to force an upwind state to share the burden of reducing other upwind states' emissions. EPA, and then in discussing emission, may require termination of only a subset of each state's contribution.
Right, but I think you're...
This argument was just not raised in Michigan.
I think the argument the petitioners are presently making was not presented in Michigan in the way that they're making it now. But what was presented is the following. In Michigan, there was an analytical process by which EPA determined the inclusion of states in the NOx SIP call, very much like here, although Mr. Kaiser is correct, the process was slightly different. It used the type of screening, quantitative screening threshold they used here. It used some other factors as well, but the end result was as described by this court's in Michigan a fairly relatively low threshold for determining which states would be included in the rule. That's the way in which I was saying it's similar, in that it was used as a screening mechanism to decide which linkages were significant enough to allow the state to be included for further analysis.
And the complaint was by the states in the brief was, by using cost, you are treating us unequally from other states, right? As compared to other states, we're not getting equal treatment.
Well, that was certainly part of their argument, sir.
And it should be, each state should be required to do its own significant, reduce its own significant contribution. But what was never raised and wasn't at issue in Michigan was an argument that a state had to reduce more than its own significant contribution. And that's where North Carolina kicks in and says that would absolutely be forbidden by the plain text of the statute, and that Michigan didn't address
it. I disagree with that, Your Honor. And in fact, there's an express passage in the court's decision in Michigan where the court says even the small contributors must make reductions attributable to highly cost-effective controls. What that means...
I guess what we're saying is that there is that language in Michigan, very clearly rejecting that, what I'll call inequality among states argument, all right? And we said it was fine for EPA to proceed that way. But the argument today is, for example, if Alabama is significantly contributing 100, but only 99 of that is over the 1% threshold, you cannot control Alabama by forcing it to put on controls that get rid of 100.
I understand that's the argument, but here the way in which it's identical, and maybe it's helpful if I just work through the sort of analytical construct, and then you can tell me if I'm wrong. But the way this case, in my view, is exactly the same as Michigan, is that there's the two-part inquiry. The first part was not a determination of significant contribution. It was a analytical screening mechanism. Granted, it was similar in Michigan, but not exactly the same. But still, analytically, the purpose of it was to figure out which linkages on some level were high enough to warrant further examination. What is important about Michigan, was important about here, is that Michigan was about how do we define significant contribution? How do we find it? Is it exclusively with regard to air quality considerations? Can cost effectiveness be a part of that? That's a way in which this case is the same. So when they say EPA, the screening portion of its analysis, determined what the state's significant contribution is, it's just not true. It wasn't true in Michigan. It's not true here. What EPA determined that portion of its analysis was which linkages for particular states were significant enough to warrant inclusion or at least a further look to determine what the significant contribution is. In both cases, this one and Michigan, the way that significant contribution was then defined and the budget set was with regard to an air quality and cost effectiveness analysis, which the court in Michigan said was okay, even if for some small contributors that might seem unfair to them. So that's the way in which this case is exactly the same. Now, as to the 1%.
Do you understand the phrase small contributors to be someone who's contributing less than 1%?
I think what the court was reacting to in Michigan was arguments presented where you say you have a big industrial state in the Midwest that's fairly close to a non-attainment area. Obviously, they're contributing a higher amount of pollution to a downwind non-attainment problem than someone who's more distant. And the court said that in Michigan. That's the kind of scenario that was being raised as unfair by certain parties in Michigan, and the court rejected that argument. Now, with regard to the 1% issue in this case...
But again, that's just the inequality among states argument. That's not... A separate argument, which is quite distinct, which is there is an outer bound to how far EPA can go.
I don't think that I recall anyone in Michigan bringing that argument down to the level of granularity
exactly.
That they have
That's
here.
The problem.
But the overall argument is the same. It's saying you should treat people who make smaller contributions differently from people who make bigger contributions in terms of their how you
But then to follow up with Judge Kavanaugh's question, there's no outer limit to that? At what point does the EPA lose its authority?
Well, there's certainly an outer limit of reasonableness, and we have a very reasonable record here. But let me make one point.
Well, just to follow up on Judge Griffith's question, could, on the authority of this provision, EPA require a state to reduce its emissions so much beyond its total emissions that go even out of state?
I don't think that issue is presented in this case, because what we have...
But what's the answer to that question?
Well, I think
your theory's
there's a limit of reasonableness in all rulemakings. I don't think EPA can require a state to, for instance, extirpate all of its emissions, as the court remarked in Michigan. That was something that the court said, but that wasn't presented in Michigan, and it's not presented here.
I think your legal theory would allow EPA, on the basis of a good neighbor provision, to actually reduce a state's emissions beyond even the total out-of-state emissions of that state, put aside significant contribution and attainment. And that seems to be where your legal theory leads, and that seems absurd.
I think that you need to look at a legal theory in connection with the record, mm-hmm. and in connection with this court's review under the arbitrary and capricious standard. Now, what we have here is we don't have that kind of an extreme scenario. I don't think we need to answer that question. What we have here...
The purpose of a hypothetical question on a legal issue is to determine whether your legal theory holds up. And if you can't answer the hypothetical, then that suggests you have a problem.
We don't have a problem, and I'll answer your hypothetical. The definition of significant contribution and the approach taken to it in Michigan and here depends on a determination of cost-effectiveness, okay? For something to be cost-effective for a particular state, it must be something that that state can do at a reasonable cost for reasonable economic environmental impact.
So is that yes to my hypothetical?
No. The point is that the cost-effectiveness inquiry presupposes reasonableness. It's built into it. In other words, a state's not going to be asked to do something that is completely super expensive for a trivial amount of environmental gain. The whole concept of cost effectiveness, and as it was applied here and in Michigan, was to look at what the state was being asked to do and see if it makes sense, both in terms of cost and the environmental results. And so in both cases, you would never reach the extreme hypothetical that you're talking about, because the legal approach that EPA took itself builds in a concept of reasonableness. And that's just what happened here.
I agree with Mr. Davis and Mr. Keisler that this argument was raised below in comment period?
No, not at all. And in fact, that was one of our arguments, one of our main arguments in this case. I mean, it's not just this argument, it's also their cost threshold argument. And many of their arguments, there's no, you know, if these are things that they were really serious about under Vermont Yankee and decades of administrative law, they had an obligation to comment forcefully. They pointed to Wisconsin and Tennessee's comments as their basis for saying that EPA should have embarked on a wholly new calculation of the extent to which their control regime would result in any particular state going below.
There certainly is some discussion of the problems of pushing a state below the one, or regulating a state that is contributing less than 1%, right? I mean, that's in the comments, right?
Let's look at the comments. They've cited to Wisconsin and Tennessee. Wisconsin was arguing for a more stringent control regime, not a less stringent one as they are arguing here. Wisconsin's comment was that we're concerned that a cost-effectiveness approach might not help Wisconsin enough. We want people to reduce emissions more. That doesn't seem to be what they're arguing here. Tennessee has one sentence where they said, you know, you might want to look at, or I think their words were, you should consider whether lower cost measures would enable state to meet the 1% threshold. There's nothing in there about any of their legal theories, nothing in there about EPA should embark on the type of quantitative analysis of over-control that the petitioners are now suggesting. Nothing. If that's what they really wanted, they should have commented.
But the point of North Carolina, I thought, was to remand for EPA to do this in a way that would comply with the statute, making clear repeatedly, multiple times in the opinion, that one thing EPA cannot do is force an individual state to reduce its emissions by more than its own significant contribution to downwind non-attainment. That is clear as day in the North Carolina opinion. Now, I grant you, you have to look at Michigan too, but from the North Carolina opinion, that issue was teed up front and center for EPA.
Look, in North Carolina and in Michigan, this court was clear that what the goal of the statute is to eliminate significant contribution. Court has already said in binding precedent of this circuit that what is a significant contribution can be defined in terms of cost effectiveness, even if that does have varying impacts on states, depending on how big or small their contributors are and that sort of thing. That is what we're talking about. We've got, this court is already, they are making an original argument based on the statute as if Michigan didn't exist, as if North Carolina didn't exist. You brought up North Carolina. Let's talk about it. In North Carolina, this court was critical of three specific components of care. On these issues, there's other issues as well, but on these issues, all of the excerpts that petitioners quote have to do with three things. One, insufficiently limited emissions trading program. Two, the establishment of SO2 budgets based on Title IV allowances. And three, the use of equitable fuel factors in establishment of NOx budgets. In each of those sections of the opinion, I don't need to tell the court what its own decisions say, but the court was clear and says, in Michigan, we approve the use of cost effectiveness approach to significant contribution, but this wasn't it, either because of unlimited trading or because of fuel factors or because of the SO2 budgets or because that result of that was too regional and not state-specific enough approach. EPA took North Carolina to heart. Every aspect of this rule was a serious attempt to address the concerns raised in North Carolina. What EPA did not have an obligation to do in this case, though, was to address these issues as if the precedent of this court, starting from Michigan, didn't exist. This court reaffirmed that precedent in North Carolina.
Reaffirmed that cost factors can be considered. What do you think the sentence in North Carolina means that says EPA may not require some states to exceed the mark?
Of its significant contribution. It just depends on what. That begs the question of how you define significant contribution. We come back to 15 almost years of precedent from this court saying that significant contribution is properly defined with respect to cost effectiveness. Look, if I my time is running out, I do want to address.
Yeah, well, you'd never be able to exceed the mark. I mean, that would give EPA carte blanche.
Well, let's be honest. I think that there are people who could say, I don't see Michigan. If I was deciding Michigan, I would have decided a different way. I don't see where, Judge Sentel wrote a very strong dissent in that case. But the fact remains that Michigan is the law of the circuit until an en banc decision or decision of the Supreme Court changes that. And what Michigan said is that significant contribution can properly be defined with respect
to
cost effectiveness.
Go back to this. The way I read it was Michigan said that the fact that you're having to shoulder a large share of the burden vis-a-vis, say, Pennsylvania or Ohio, is tough because cost factors are going to result in unequal treatment among states, and you can't complain just because someone else is not being as regulated as heavily as you think. But then North Carolina makes clear that EPA can't come in and tell that state, okay, you have to shoulder a burden that's beyond your own significant contribution to downwind attainment. So it's an inequality argument in Michigan. Here it's more an argument you can't force the state to exceed the mark being significant.
And what the court was saying, the background to that statement was that EPA, in the court's view, had departed from the cost effectiveness approach to significant contribution that it had used in Michigan. And EPA returned to that here. My time is up. If I may be indulgent for
one more thing.
Okay.
In North Carolina, it also said, and I'll give you another sentence, it says EPA has no authority to force an upwind state to share the burden of reducing other upwind states' emissions. Isn't that necessarily what's going on?
The court said that, as I was saying before, that came in a specific portion of the decision.
That's not a general statement of legal interpretation of the statute?
Well, of course not. If that were read as broadly as you're suggesting, it would read Section 110A2D out of the statute. Of course an upwind state has to help downwind states reach change.
Other upwind states. It says to share the burden of reducing other upwind states' emissions. In other words, you can be forced all the way up to the limit to reduce your own significant contribution to downwind state non-attainment. But what you can't be forced to do is to go beyond that to alleviate Pennsylvania, Ohio, whatever, all in the name of achieving better results downstate.
Right. I don't disagree that there are isolated sentences in North Carolina, which petitioners have tried to use in support of their arguments. But if you go back and read the full context, which each of those statements appear, it is quite clear that they are tied to the specific flaw in care that the court perceived, whether it was the equitable nature of the Knox budget process or the use of acid rain allowances.
And in the context of a regional approach.
Exactly. And
what was the other thing you wanted to address?
Well, I did want to, there were some comments about cost thresholds, and if I maybe just like have
I was looking
tiny bit of time to address that.
All right. Let's go through with the other people who are arguing for the agency, and then if we've missed something, you'll have a chance in rebuttal.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Norman Rave from the Department of Justice. I'm here to address the issues concerning the FIPS, maintenance areas, notice, and
plain text versus functionalism.
I'm sorry?
Plain text versus functionalism. What is EPA's position?
Well, Your Honor, as the court has said repeatedly, policy cannot overturn the plain language of the statute. And the structure of the statute is just simply not as represented by petitioners. I think Judge Rogers described it quite well. 110A of the statute says that after EPA promulgates a NAAQS, states are required to submit a SIP. Part of that SIP has to be to address their significant contribution to downwind non-attainment or interference with maintenance. If the states fail to do that, if they fail to submit the SIP within those 3 years, or if they submit a SIP that isn't adequate to meet the statutory requirement, then EPA either will make a finding of failure to submit or will disapprove the SIP.
All right. Part of the argument, as I understand it, is that EPA has taken upon itself, after having issued simultaneously issuing the NAAQS standard, to come up with these rules that tell the states exactly what they have to do to meet the good neighbor obligation in their SIP plan, so that EPA, having taken the initiative to assist the states in this manner, has necessarily read the statute to say, once we put out this rule, the states have to have, a reasonable period of time in which to submit a SIP that conforms to this standard in the new rule.
But that's totally inconsistent with the facts, Your Honor. The facts are that the NAAQS were promulgated. The states had their opportunity to submit SIPs.
How would they know what to put in on this issue?
They can calculate they know what their emissions are. They know the meteorology. They can calculate it. This is being done in states that aren't part of the transport rule and aren't.
You've described in your brief, I think correctly, how complex this is, how many inputs are in, how many assumptions have to be made. It's just a shot in the dark for the state, isn't it, knowing what the emissions
budget. No, because they only have to address it themselves. That modeling has been going on for
That makes it all the harder, right, because they're trying to figure out what's going on in various downwind states, not knowing how EPA is going to assess other states' contributions to those downwind states.
But, Your Honor, they have the obligation to do that. That's what the statute is very clear.
What's the point?
Well, what is the point of them wanting to do a SIP, but I mean their argument has a fundamental.
Their point of wanting to do a SIP now is that they would prefer, rather than the federal government, to pick out the individual sources in their states in such a way as to determine how to meet the emissions budget, which is what I thought the statute was designed to do in the first place.
And they can do that starting in 2013. Mm-hmm. They can submit
SIPs.
Not in 2012, which is
why?
Because the EPA promulgated.
Why allow it in 2013?
Because the states were always free to submit a SIP.
What we need to help on, I think, is a state says, or EPA says, it's a very complicated matter, all right, you know, and the states we've identified are linked to a monitor, and they're significantly contributing, but they're also contributing elsewhere. So I am a state administrative agency head trying to figure out what to put in the state's SIP to meet my good neighbor obligations. And as I understand EPA's position, it's that the data is publicly available and the states can do their own modeling to figure out what level of emissions they must reduce in order to meet their good neighbor policy obligations.
That's correct.
And we're being met with the argument that, A, as I said before, EPA has jumped in and said, oh, we'll tell you what to do, so therefore they get the right to a reasonable period of time after EPA issues its final rule, or B, it's just so complicated we can't do it on our own.
Well, A is simply not true factually, because the states, I mean, it confuses the chronology, because the states did have the opportunity to do it. EPA stepped in only after the states failed to do so. So that chronology is basically backwards. It wasn't that EPA took the initiative to step in, and this goes all the way back to the NOx SIP call. The reason that EPA has repeatedly had to step in is because the states have not addressed the problem of interstate transport. As Judge Rogers mentioned earlier, Congress has had to amend the statute because the states haven't been addressing interstate transport. So EPA stepped in only because the states were not. I hadn't done it. That was the basis for the NOx SIP call. It was the basis for CARE. And the same is true with the transport rule. The states have not addressed the issue on their own, and therefore EPA has had to step in. And
well, wait a second. You did SIP calls in 98 and 2005, correct?
Or no, not in CARE.
SIP calls after the after NOx in 98, right?
In 98, EPA used a SIP call. A SIP call is designed for when an existing approved SIP proves to be inadequate.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what the mechanism EPA used for the NOx SIP call. But it does not apply, it doesn't override Section 110C1 that says when EPA has failed, when EPA has found a failure to submit or has disapproved a SIP, it must promulgate a FIP within 2 years.
Right.
And EPA has made those threshold findings. And if the plaintiff, if the petitioner's argument here is that those findings are incorrect, which is really what they're arguing here, what they're arguing here is that EPA should not have disapproved their SIPs or should not have made the finding of failure to submit because for some reason they were excused from finding it, that was the place to before the court in this case.
I think their argument is it just isn't appropriate to require a state to do a SIP based on the significant contribution issue until they know what the emissions budget is.
And well,
that theory has a ton of common sense behind it. Now we're trying to figure out whether it fits within the statutory text, but you were painting an image of recalcitrant states and but how are they supposed to know what to do on the SIP call until they know what the emissions budget is?
Well,
I mean, they can guess, sure, waste a ton of money guessing with some formula that's not going to match EPA's and get rejected. That's really nonsensical.
So, but you're saying is that they should, what they're really saying is they should get a SIP to in order to, you know, have several more years of delay before a plan goes
into. It's not delay. They don't know the target.
But the effect would be that there would be no emission reductions for another 3 years while they submitted a SIP.
Okay, and that's a great policy reason for saying forget the SIPs. But that's not what the statutory scheme is all about.
But the statutory scheme is that if EPA, 110C1, the plain language of 110C1 says that if once EPA disapproves a SIP or makes a finding a failure to submit, which they have done in every single case here, EPA is obligated to promulgate a FIP within 2 years.
But, Mr. Rabe, do you agree with the premise of Judge Kavanaugh's question that the states don't know what the object is?
No, Your Honor. They don't know what EPA's rule is going to be, but they certainly are able to discern. They can make a term. This is how states that are not in the transport rule and not in CARE deal with the situation. They do modeling. They know their emissions.
Wait, but they don't have to deal with the significant contribution to downwind states issue.
Of course they do, Your Honor. Every state has to deal with that issue. That applies to every state.
They don't have to make reductions based on EPA's rule.
Again, you're turning the chronology around, Your Honor. Okay, the rule is a response to the fact that the states haven't done it. The statute is what requires them. 110A2DI requires states in their SIPs to eliminate their significant contribution to downwind non-attainment or interference with maintenance. And it's only because the states didn't do that that EPA has stepped in to promulgate regulations and to promulgate rules.
Is your point that in the first instance, the state was supposed to figure out what significant contribution means?
That's the way the statute is written, Your Honor. That is what the statute says. That's what A210A2DI, it says, within 3 years, states shall submit a SIP. That SIP shall include provisions to eliminate significant contribution to downwind non-attainment and interference with maintenance. The statute imposes that requirement.
And the state has the capability of doing that for the reasons I suggested EPA had explained when it disapproved North Carolina's CARE SIP.
That's correct, Your Honor. The states can make that effort, and they can submit SIPs to EPA. Again, that is how the process works in the states that aren't included in these transport regions.
So the transport rule is one way states can meet their obligations, but states could figure out another way as well?
They could, Your Honor. If a state submits a SIP that demonstrates that it's eliminated significant contribution to downwind states and EPA approved it, they would not be subject to the transport rule. But they have not done that. And in fact, many states didn't, only some of the states subject to CARE submitted SIPs. Some did, some didn't. You know, there are still a large number of states that are subject to the CARE FIPs. CARE was implemented through FIPs as well, where EPA promulgated the rule. About a year later, no state had submitted a SIP. It promulgated FIPs for CARE. And then later, some states did in fact submit SIPs.
Can you explain further something I didn't understand, which you said states not included by this rule, not included in this rule in their SIP still must include information about contribution to other states?
Yes, Your Honor, that applies to this rule only.
That work?
They do modeling. This is, for instance, you know, the transport rule only basically applies to the eastern two-thirds of the country.
Right.
And so states in the western one-third of the country have the same statutory requirement.
I understand that, but do they do in their SIPs steps that are specifically designed to prevent contributions?
They make a demonstration either that they're not making a significant contribution or they demonstrate what controls they're putting on to eliminate significant contribution. Yes, they make those demonstrations.
And aren't those controls they're putting on are to eliminate the pollution in their own states?
Well, to the extent that additional controls are needed to eliminate significant contribution, they have to put those on as well. This rule, you know, the significant contribution requirement applies to all 50 states, Your Honor.
I understand that. The question is what the trigger is for significant contribution. I assume EPA doesn't think there are a bunch of states out there that are significantly contributing to downwind non-attainment that are not included in the rule.
They're different issues. They're not included. But the EPA has examined those, and where they've discerned that in a particular case, a state is significantly contributing to another state, they are required to put on controls.
Maybe I'm missing something, but does EPA think any state not included in the rule is significantly contributing to downwind non-attainment in another state?
I believe that is the case, Your Honor. I have to look at the facts, but the rule is included because of the modeling and the sort of meteorology that makes sense to include these states in the rule for transport purposes. It's not a finding that no other state. In fact, there are other states that do significantly contribute to non-attainment. Those are dealt with on a state by state basis.
Let me ask you about C1, if I can. You say, and your brief says, you know, EPA made all the findings that were required as to all the states covered by the rule such that it could proceed to issue a FIP.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, I see where the administrator made findings of failure to submit or disapproved a state SIP.
Yes, Your Honor.
For example, with regard to the 2006 24-hour PM standard.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the administrator published those.
Yes, Your Honor.
What about the other standards and states not covered by the 2006?
The EPA made the same finding, made similar findings, which were also published. Most of them predated CARE. They were the basis for the CARE FIP. So for every state and for each of the three NACs that are drilled by the transport rule, EPA has made a finding, either made a finding of failure to submit or has disapproved a SIP. Because that's the agency's legal authority. It's the legal prerequisite for the agency to have authority to issue a FIP. And if the states believed that those findings and those decisions are improper because of this theory they're putting forth here, which is that they weren't required to submit a SIP, that's where they should be raising it.
And you're going to allow them to do SIPs again, though, in 2013?
The rule specifically discusses that, yes, Your Honor. They're allowed to do SIPs.
Why is that?
Well, they always have the opportunity to do a SIP, and if EPA approves a SIP, then the FIP is essentially supplanted. That's standard. And EPA does FIPs for other purposes as well. This isn't the only FIP EPA does. EPA does FIPs on a number of occasions for a variety of reasons when states have not produced an adequate SIP. So it's not a unique situation here. I think my time is up. Does the court have questions on any of the other areas on my list here?
Because I have you listed as addressing the modeling issues as well.
In
regard specifically to the issues that were raised by the petitioners.
Well, the issues that were raised in argument, I think, are actually Mr. Galtieri's issue. I was going to simply address the very narrow issues they raised about the IPM modeling for use in setting budgets. If the court has questions, I'm happy to answer them. But the issues concerning the broader modeling issues are Mr. Galtieri is prepared to answer.
All right, fine. And I do have a question on the notice and comment.
Okay, Your Honor.
Which issues do you think are not properly before the court with regard to lack of contention of failure to provide adequate notice and comment?
All of their issues, Your Honor.
They're properly, even though the petitions for rehearing are pending?
They're pending, Your Honor, but I think the gist of the statute is that the agency is supposed to be able to rule on them first. They have to be presented and ruled on by the agency.
So there is no notice and comment issue that is properly before the court?
Yes, Your Honor. That is certainly our view. We think that's supported by the court's decisions that we cited in our brief, and that's what the statute says.
Well, the reason I raised it is because we don't know what's in those petitions. They're pending.
They are pending.
Cover all these petitioners who are before us?
There are, I think, 62 of pending petitions. I don't know. I don't know that anybody matched them up, but they certainly addressed. A lot of the issues that have been raised in the litigation are raised there, but certainly the issues that are the focus of their notice argument, which are the data issues.
The data issues in Texas.
In Texas and in other states in terms of setting the budget harder. Now, and of course, EPA has provided, since the rule was promulgated, an additional opportunity for comment on those budget issues, and it has promulgated a rule revising them and is considering further comments on that issue.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the Court, David Galtieri from the Department of Justice on behalf of EPA. I am to address this morning the issues related to air quality monitoring and the compliance deadlines. It's already been a long morning of argument, and if the Court doesn't have any questions on the compliance deadline issue, we're happy to stand on our briefs on that issue and just focus on the air quality monitoring questions. EPA reasonably used modeling to identify the areas that would struggle to meet air quality standards with an interstate transport rule. At every step in this process, EPA's approach was reasonable and consistent with this court's directions. EPA used modeling tools that were undeniably suited to the task, and there's no challenge to the tools that were used. EPA followed its own modeling guidance, as we discussed in the brief. EPA's model was chock-full of real-world data. 5 years of air quality monitoring data formed the basis of the model and anchored and cabined the limits of the model, as well as emission inventory data and other data. What's significant here and addresses in part, and there are other answers, but it addresses in part many of the questions that Mr. Keisler raised, is that EPA validated its model. The petitioners don't really, the petitioners have a very high burden here to challenge EPA's use of modeling. This course precedents are clear that EPA models don't have to be perfect. They just have to have some reasonable relationship to reality. EPA doesn't have to conduct perfect studies.
Mr. Keisler said 44% of the projections are flawed for 2014. Can you respond to that?
Right. I would like to respond to that. The broader point that he's making is he says that EPA failed to here the term he uses is benchmark their model. EPA validated the model, which is the proper modeling term, and EPA validated the model. What's important to understand is that the model. There's actually two stages of modeling that were done. EPA first used the model to develop the base year, the base case that it started with, which was anchored around the year 2005, and then added more inputs to the model to fast forward to 2012 and make projections there. The modeling exercise is the same. The modeling practice is the same. Validation of models is very important. EPA validated this model. We discussed in our brief the way that the 2005 base case was validated, and I'd like to just provide one brief quote from Joint Appendix 2419 from EPA's Air Quality Modeling TSD, which says, the predictions from CAMEX, which is the model used, from the 2005 base case were compared to measured concentrations in order to evaluate the performance of the modeling platform for replicating observed concentrations. That is the validation exercise that EPA used. EPA compared the function and the operation of its model with the real-world data. It did that for the year 2005. It had to do it for the year 2005 because this court directed EPA to back out anything having to do with care. This entire modeling exercise was to scrub, sanitize, choose your verb, to get care out of the analysis. That is essential. That is the very function of the model. What petitioners are complaining about is that EPA didn't validate the model using data values from the years 2008 to 2010. We'll start with the fact that that data was not in the record. That analysis isn't in the record. It postdates the record and is waived for that reason. We addressed that in our brief. But the more important reason is that data indisputably reflects significant emissions reductions that arose from care. That data is completely worthless to the process of validating a model whose very purpose is to model conditions without care.
So your response to Mr. Keisler then would be that, I was looking for this footnote in your brief. I thought it was 43, but it's the one where he cited it saying that I thought it was 43%. Would be an attainment in 2014,
right.
And I'll just paraphrase his argument, not to misrepresent it, that the air quality will be worse under the transport rule than it would be, you know, with...
Right. There are a couple of comparisons that he makes, and... A number of them, as we discuss in detail in the brief, for the reason that the impacts of care are involved, they render them completely apples to oranges and irrelevant to the task. The footnote he was referring to is that EPA projects some air quality in 2014 after the remedy is in effect to be worse than the 2008 and 2010 design values. All that is telling us, again, the baseline for this rule is what EPA, and the basis of applicability is what EPA projected the attainment and maintenance problems will be in 2012 after backing care out. So any comparison between 2008 to 2010 data that includes care emission reductions when compared with something projected in the future is only going to tell you how significant the emission reductions were that related to care.
All right, so I understand the apples to oranges point, but I want to be clear that I understood part of his argument to be that were care simply continued, the air quality would be better in 2014 in some of these jurisdictions.
Yes, that the point
than under the transport rule. So therefore, how can EPA justify imposing more rigorous controls in the transport rule when the result is less desirable air quality?
Right. There are a number of problems with that argument. First of all, the very notion of continuing care, as I explained, EPA's task here is to develop a completely new rule. This court invalidated care because the factors it used in establishing the budgets, the court found to be invalid. There is no way for EPA to just sort of look out on the horizon and say, where are we now, and let's just lock that in without at least indirectly piggybacking on the budgets that this court already threw out as invalid. EPA had to literally start from scratch. So trying to compare these two regimes, saying one is more stringent or does something differently than the other, is very, very difficult to do. EPA had a completely different way of choosing the receptors of interest in this rule. The budgets are not the same under this rule as they were under CARE. They went up, they went down in some states. That's another apples to oranges problem. But here, as we explained in the brief, although there's going to be projected to be some attainment in 2014, irrespective of any of these rules, well, first of all, that attainment can be driven by a number of factors, economics, natural gas prices, low sulfur coal prices, the recession, electricity demand. Those are a lot of impermanent dynamic factors.
So the variability factor here takes that into account?
Well, the way we took it into account, the way EPA took it into account is to say, We can't regulate based on all of these unpredictable factors. We have to know what's going to be permanent, what's going to be enforceable, what's going to be predictable in the future. And without a transport regulation, no emissions cap is going to be able to be sustained and be able to maintain attainment that is achieved. And let's not forget, 43% are in attainment. 57% are going to be in non-attainment. There are still plenty of maintenance and attainment problems. This rule is based on the conditions in 2012, not 2014. Whatever may happen in 2014, if there's a dramatic change, a state can always submit a SIP revision and try to get itself out of the rule if that bears out. But the reality is, this court told EPA to pay specific attention to the interfere with maintenance prong. That is the purpose of an emissions cap. It is set at a particular point in time, and as our record amply demonstrates, that's going to be necessary in order to maintain any attainment that's achieved. We got to get people into attainment, and then we have to maintain it. That's the concept of a cap. The other scenario that was addressed is to trying to say, well, in 2008 to 2010, most everybody is in attainment now. This rule doesn't really need to do very much. The problem with that rationale is they are in attainment, obviously, because of CARE, for the most part. Once CARE is replaced with the transport rule, if we were to apply the analysis that they would like, where we sort of use a baseline of the, rosy air quality conditions we have today and say, well, there's attainment all over the place, and if, we should be looking at non-attainment and put those states in the rule, well, there'd be nobody in the rule. CARE would go away. There'd be no emission cap at all, and those emissions are going to shoot right back up again. That's the very premise of the rule. That's why we can't compare 2008 to 2010 data with the way EPA projected the world would be without a CARE in 2012.
Can I ask you on the compliance deadline? It was 5 months, and the complaint is that that's unreasonable, especially when compared to past compliance deadlines, which were several years. Can you address that?
Yes.
Are you going to blame it on us?
Pardon me?
You're going to blame it on us?
So it seems like you've got that part of our brief covered.
Check.
Let me fast forward to another factor beyond your clear instructions. The fault with that argument, and we saw it in the stay briefing, and they raise it again here, they completely fix on one option. This is a trading program. This is a cap and trade program. It is market-based. It is flexible. EPA talks about a litany of things that can be done to come into compliance. They fixate on the ability of sort of presuming every source is going to have to install some form of control within a five-month deadline, or they even complain about 2014 being too late. It's expressed in much more detail in our brief, but certainly for most scenarios, most types of equipment, EPA's model runs and projections of the least cost option for the rule found that, you know, that equipment, very little equipment would need to be installed, if any, within this time frame. There's a number of things that they can do.
Am I right that in past situations, EPA's given several years to come into compliance, even though it's the same kind of trading?
Well, again, there's a misapprehension here. This rule for the 2012 deadline, which is the one, you know, most immediately upon us, EPA only looked at things that in its judgment could be done. It really pulled back and limited the number of things that were expected to be done within the time frame. EPA was highly cognizant of that time frame. So what did EPA do? Almost all of the reductions that are assumed in EPA's budgets and modeling come from doing things like, instead of running your NOx controls during the ozone season, you're going to run them year-round. You can run your controls harder and more efficiently. There's certainly allowances, and there's allowance trading. And with the revisions rule, allowance trading, taking out the assurance penalty provisions until 2014, allowance trading is going to be that much easier. Budgets are that much easier. Sources can shift generation to lower emitting units. They can switch their fuels. There's a very long list of things that can be done, and in fact, EPA's presumptions in its modeling were that those things would be done. There were scarce few examples where EPA was presuming that any significant amount of equipment would be installed. And in fact, to the extent EPA did assume that, EPA was only assuming for looking at the utilities to say this is the least cost method, this is the most efficient method. There are other things they can do. Nobody's forcing them or mandating them to put controls on. They've written a brief as if this is an emissions control technology regulation that's requiring everybody to do it and run out and get it all done at the same time. That's not what this rule is about.
All right. Thank you.
This court has nothing further.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We hear from the state and city respondent interveners.
Yes. Simon Heller for the states and cities supporting the transport rule. The transport rule represents the first time that the states have an assurance that the interstate pollution that blocks their ability to meet air quality standards at issue will end, and will end in a timely way. The downwind states need this assurance in order to achieve and maintain healthier air for their residents. And in that sense, there's a cooperative federalism, a competing cooperative federalism point here, which is that downwind states have to meet NACs, and they need the assistance, in this case, of the EPA to limit the significant contributions from upwind states. Now, the states on behalf of whom I'm speaking include both downwind and upwind states, all of which support issuance of the FIPS in this case. And I wanted to talk a little bit about why we believe issuance of FIPS here and the FIPS themselves are a reasonable approach. First, as EPA has explained, they were clearly authorized under subsection C1 because all the relevant SIPs were either disapproved or not submitted. And I think there's a bit of a red herring going on here, which is states have had opportunity using their own modeling to develop their own SIPs. EPA has found either that those FIPs are inadequate and hence disapproved them, or that they were not submitted at all. Now, in those SIPs, it's not simply a matter of guesswork what states must do to eliminate their significant contributions to non-attainment or maintenance in downwind areas. States can model those things, and they can make a good faith effort to eliminate those problems for downwind states. If states had done so, they may have taken an approach that was different than what is contained in the FIPS. They may have proposed limitations on other emissions other than EGUs. They didn't do that. And of course, when that happens, and when EPA is then required or at least authorized to issue FIPS, it has to set out a definition of significant contribution for those states that have failed in their statutory obligation.
In your theory that the states could have just done SIPs in other ways, presumably those would have been disapproved eventually.
It's not at all clear that they would have been disapproved. An example is Delaware, one of the states that's a respondent intervening here, that was removed from the rule by EPA. In fact, I sort of think of this as an interim FIP. First of all, many of the states knew for a year before the rule was finalized that FIPs were on the way. They didn't propose SIPs that might have reduced or eliminated their significant contributions. And beginning in 2013 and 2014, they can replace these FIPs with their own SIPs. Now, the question arose, well, why not just do SIP calls now? And I think that's because the NACs that are at issue here must be achieved in a timely way. Time is of the essence, as this court said in the North Carolina decision. So having a FIP in place for a year or a year and a half before then the states can propose their own methods for dealing with the problems caused for downwind states is entirely reasonable.
Anything further?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. All right, counsel for industry respondent interveners.
Yes, may it please the court. My name is Brendan Collins, and I'll be presenting argument today on behalf of Calpine Corporation, Exelon Corporation, and Public Service Enterprise Group, with apologies for my voice. I wanted to bring this court some practical insights from our client's industry here, which address some of the concerns I believe that the panel has raised this morning about some of the issues that Mr. Keisler and others here have brought to the court's attention. The environment today is such in the electric industry that there is an enormous amount of excess capacity, particularly with low-emitting sources such as natural gas and so forth, that is available to be dispatched here. There is no requirement in many cases, as Mr. Galtieri hinted at, that sources that are equipped with emission controls, be they NOx-targeted emission controls or even SO2-targeted emission controls, operate them at all times or operate them at their highest levels of capacity. And what that means, Your Honors, is that when this rule is allowed to go into effect, the first and foremost means in which reductions will be achieved is that sources that have already invested the capital, have already had this equipment in place, will operate it and will reduce their emissions to free up allowances to meet the needs of the marketplace. Now, without the incentives provided, and in particular the $500 level that EPA selected, there is no incentive to operate controls, because if it costs you $500 to operate it and you can buy an allowance for $200, you'll buy the allowance rather than operate the controls. All of our clients on both sides of the room are in this business to make money. And that is the choice that will be made as a business decision. So the principal problem with the ideas promoted by the petitioners here today, by the industry petitioners, is that if EPA were to use different cost effectiveness standards for different states, say $200 for Texas versus $500 for Pennsylvania, what would happen necessarily is that the higher cost state sources would look to the lower cost states to buy their allowances, and allowance prices would trend toward an average across the entire region. In order to prevent this, EPA would have to prevent interstate trading of allowances, which is a result that, with apologies to those here, I don't think anyone on industry on either side of the room would want. And so that's exactly what EPA did with SO2 allowances. There is no trading between Group 1 and Group 2. And so, Your Honor, I think the EPA has selected here a market-based principle that creates an allowance market that will operate in harmony with the electricity market. It's exactly what industry wanted, and it's exactly consistent with the mandates of the Clean Air Act that EPA consider and implement trading programs that will be calibrated to maximize cost effectiveness. Thank you very much.
Thank you. and the public health respondent.
May it please the court, Sean Donahue for the public health interveners. The National Ambient Air Quality Standards are the heart of the Clean Air Act. Non-attainment of those provisions carries serious costs for public health. And it also carries serious regulatory burdens for affected states. And interstate air pollution confounds the state-oriented scheme the Act has for implementing those standards. A state that is whose air is impaired by transported pollution can't directly regulate that pollution, and indeed its efforts to regulate more stringently in-state may perversely increase transported pollution as polluting activity migrates out of state. So a functional analysis of the Clean Air Act would tend not to support an argument that an upwind state should, notwithstanding apparently clear text, get several more years to reduce the degree to which it's polluting its neighbors. Secondly, as Mr. Heller noted, time is of the essence. That was, of course, a major holding of North Carolina, which emphasized the textual basis for making sure that reductions in significant contribution happen quickly, namely the expeditiously as practicable language that is part of the statute by reference in the good neighbor provision, and the requirement that downwind attainment deadlines be considered in achieving reductions. And a good example is the city of Baltimore, which is currently a serious non-attainment area for ozone. It faces a maximum deadline of 2013, or it will be reclassified as a severe non-attainment deadline, which will mean more stringent regulatory controls based on the terms of the Act itself. And the 2013 attainment will be gauged by emissions in 2012. And EPA in the preamble gave many more examples of ways in which the reductions in this initial period, which carries very low obligations, operating existing controls, dispatching more cleaner units, there's no requirement to install expensive controls. Why this interim period, 2012 to 2014, is essential for downwind states to meet those deadlines.
You made an excellent point, obviously, about the problem with regulating in this area, given that federalism-based approaches don't necessarily work so well. But the problem from our perspective is the statute adopts a federalism-based approach in the sense that, although it recognizes you have to eliminate your significant contributions to downwind states, non-attainment, it doesn't seem to allow you to go beyond that so as to reduce what's coming from another state. So, you know, if our job is to preserve the balance that Congress struck, it imposed a federalism-based structure on something that you say confounds federalism.
Right. Well, we think, first of all, if you're referring to the 1% argument, we think that argument was it's very well crafted, it's well done, but it's also post hoc. The agency didn't extensively analyze this question because commenters didn't raise it. EPA has said, in fact, it appears that no state would meet this condition. But the fact that there isn't an extensive analysis is a function of the fact that the petitioners and commenters didn't raise it. And we think, in fact, all these arguments, although very skillfully presented, have this character of being ultimately directed at delay. I mean, the FIP argument relates only to this interim period of 2012 to 14. Even 2013, states can use SIPs. So it's limited in its scope anyway. We think the plain language supports EPA, but even if the idea that there's this grave affront to sovereignty to use a FIP on this interim way so that the controls can be achieved to protect downwind states as the statute requires and North Carolina requires, is somewhat inconsistent with the fact that CARE also used FIPs, and many of the states covered by CARE, including Texas, has not even replaced the CARE FIP. So they could have replaced it with a SIP at any time, and they haven't done so. So in short, unless the court has further questions, we submit that the transport rule is lawful, should be upheld, and that the stay should be dissolved. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Davis.
I'd like to focus my remaining time on the FIP issue. And to start, I'd like to challenge the idea that states could do something to address significant contribution before that was defined and focus on the Delaware example that was mentioned. It's interesting, in 76 Federal Register 2857, EPA says that the Delaware SIP will either be approved or disapproved based on what happens in CSAPR, based on what the end result of EPA's modeling is. So even at that point, EPA doesn't know. And so the states, before they have the standard that they know to meet, can't do anything but guess. Now, in response to the waiver argument, we have 3 points that I'd like to make. The first is that we're not challenging the findings of failure or the disapprovals. We're challenging CSAPR's simultaneous definition of the standard and issuance of FIPS. The second point is, even assuming the waiver argument were correct, it's undisputed that CSAPR used the K6 power, or purported power, to retroactively disapprove several of these petitioning states' submittals. And so CSAPR was the first time to challenge that, and these petitions for review go to that.
Could I just be clear? You said EPA relied on K6 to disapprove?
That's right, Your Honor. Section 110K6 is the corrections rule that we talked about earlier. EPA used that for the first time in CSAPR to say that some CARE SIPs that had previously been approved, even some of them after North Carolina,
right,
were retroactively disapproved at the same time the standard was set in CSAPR. And so these...
Is that distinct from the corrections that simply said we're correcting these approved SIPs to the extent they implied that they met their good neighbor or complied with the good neighbor provision because they complied with CARE and to eliminate the provision that EPA could not issue a FIP? You're saying they did more than that under K6?
The K6, the use of K6 applied to CARE SIPs that had previously been approved. And EPA came down and in a single fell swoop said, actually, those should have been disapproved. And by the way, here's the standard you needed to meet.
So that, as to those, K5 should apply, a SIP call.
That's right, Your Honor.
And with the exception, this is a question, is that with the exception of those where the administrator acted under C1 as to the 2006 24-hour PM standard?
And this is the final point I'd like to make. We disagree with the C1 power that applies here, but even assuming that does apply, we would say that these FIPs are not severable, that all we need to show is that we preserve this as to one FIP, because if you pull one FIP out of this program, the allowance trading program can't work the way EPA intended, and the significant contribution, the collective contribution analysis that EPA performed can't work either.
When you sit, go ahead.
Even as to the remaining states where EPA properly either found a failure to submit or disapproved ASIP?
That's right, because the FIPs are interconnected. If you pull one of them out, again, the allowance trading can't work. And
well, but the whole notion that in 2013 states could come in with SIPs, and we were talking with Council that, you know, if conditions change, a SIP could be filed and a state could get out from under the rule.
But that still doesn't fix the basic problem that beginning at the first of this year, mm-hmm, the states were regulated by CSAPR without having any chance to get out from under that. Mm-hmm. I see my time has expired. Yeah.
I'd like, if I may, to just address 2 points. First, the waiver points that Mr. Lipschitz raised, and then second, a point about Mr. Galtieri's presentation on the data. First, as to waiver, Mr. Lipschitz says that we waived both the cost threshold argument and the significant contribution argument. As to the cost threshold argument, commenters specifically raised the point by presenting data at lower cost thresholds and saying those and not $500 a ton should be regulated. That's at JA 1066 to 1068 and JA 13. 1374. I was surprised to see the government suggest there was a waiver on this issue. It didn't suggest it in the brief. In fact, it didn't address the issue at all in its brief, except for two sentences on the bottom of page 39 that just repeated the ipsa dixit of the order. If there's a waiver here or a default, it's not petitioners, it's EPA's, which never looked at lower cost thresholds and never defended in its brief here its failure to do so. As to significant contribution, Judge Griffith, you had said that Tennessee's comment didn't have the full-blown legal analysis that you might have liked to see. And if that's so, that's because that comment came at the tail end of a process in which EPA had directly addressed this very issue. This issue was raised in CARE and a JA, 70 FR 25177. EPA said, commenters say we can't go below the threshold we've established. We think we can because of Michigan. And this is all the same proceeding. This is the remand from CARE. Then when they issued their notice of...
We can't go or we shouldn't go?
I'm sorry, we can go. We can go. Commenters said you can't go. EPA said we can because of Michigan. Then in the notice of proposed rulemaking here at JA 90, they said, we've considered other approaches to significant contribution. We reject the air quality approach. And they had a separate document, a technical support document explaining why. We don't call this an air quality only approach. We think that's a complete misnomer because we think they can consider cost too. But air quality only approach is EPA's way of referring to what we're arguing for here about the 1%. So when Tennessee made that comment,
those
Judge Griffith.
Those are two different things, Mr. Kaiser.
Excuse me?
Those are two different things.
What are two different things, Your Honor? I'm sorry.
Your air quality argument.
No, they have called our 1% argument, they call it air quality only. That's not what we call it, but in their brief, that's what they call it, and in the proposed rule, they said they considered that, and they rejected it. So when Tennessee made its comment...
In the technical document, they rejected the notion of air only, excluding cost. That's a different issue from the argument that... in reducing, they had to, you know, the 1% threshold.
Well, but that they addressed in CARE, and when Tennessee came back and said, again, you can't go below the threshold, it was reiterating this objection that had been made and passed upon. And this court said in NRDC versus EPA, if the agency has passed on the issue, it's okay even if the commenter hasn't raised it at all, because the real exhaustion issue is, has the agency been given an opportunity to pass on this? There is no question that the agency has thought about this and has its position. And finally, with respect...
The technical support document, as I recall, discussed two different air quality-only approaches, and the theory was that you can only reduce a state's contribution down to the threshold, which they rejected, which...
That's right, and that's the
cost in it, but it was the same basic theory, right?
That's right, and that's why the notion that the agency was caught by surprise here is completely counterfactual. This is something they have thought about, addressed, and rejected. And if I could just address Mr. Galtieri's...
But let me be clear. When Tennessee says you should consider something else, that's enough
what...
to preserve an objection in terms of statutory authority?
Yes, we think so.
After this court in Michigan and North Carolina has language indicating that that approach, the cost reduction approach, is appropriate?
Well, again, of course, we dispute the ultimate legal conclusion that it's appropriate. But on the issue...
In terms of the statute talks about the nature of the objection that has to be raised to put the agency on notice.
Right. And we're saying, Your Honor, that under this court's precedence, it would be enough if the agency had passed on the issue, even if nobody had raised it.
So you're saying, I need to be clear on this, because I didn't see this in your reply brief. You're saying that the agency in the technical document had said, we have considered this objection to the 1% in the second part of our definition of significant contribution and rejected it.
We're saying three things. We're saying first that the agency addressed this precise issue in CARE as a legal matter and said it has the authority to go below the 1%.
Yeah, but this is a totally new rulemaking, and this court said start all over again, you know.
Well, but as a matter of the proceeding, it is still the remanded proceeding. They have to substantively start over.
With due respect, if we said that, this is a whole new scheme that the agency has come up with. And the fact that an objection was raised to a regional scheme in CARE isn't the same as raising the objection in what EPA describes as state-specific.
But the objection on at 25 Federa 25177 is not an objection to a regional screen. It's exactly the objection here.
But it's in the context. That's what I'm trying to get at.
But
all
no,
of these statements about what EPA can and can't do in North Carolina were key to the fact that EPA wanted to do this regional approach.
But this was not linked to the fact that it was a regional approach, and I don't think those two things can be conflated.
In a remand, I just need to be clear, the whole record remains available, and the agency is obligated to examine the comments that were raised in the former rulemaking, and that puts it on notice that this objection is preserved.
I'm just saying that insofar as Judge Griffith or the court believed that Tennessee wasn't as full as it needed to be if you were considering it in isolation, that comes at the tail end of a process in which the agency has given explicit consideration to this issue and given in its order in CARE exactly the same answer it's giving in its brief here, so that there is no protection to the agency against someone surprising it and raising something that never has been before it. But we would rest on Tennessee's comment because we believe that is sufficient on its own, but it's certainly sufficient in combination with the fact that this is an issue that the agency specifically addressed. And if I could just address Mr. Galtieri's point on the data, which is that, you know, he said the model is very sophisticated, it's state of the art, et cetera, and so forth. You know, but if the car is beautifully constructed, but you turn on the ignition and it doesn't work, then you have to take a step back. And our point here, we stand completely on the EPA's concessions in its brief, that for 43% of these downwind sites, their wrong projections suggest that air quality will be worse after there are deeper emission cuts than there are today. And for 44% of the sites in 2014, they are projected to be in attainment in 2014.
But EPA's response is the court told us we cannot use CARE.
And
so we cannot get there through use of CARE.
And Your Honor,
off the table.
And I think EPA and we are just two ships passing on the night. They cannot reinstitute CARE. That doesn't mean that real world data, what you learn about from looking at actual emissions when CARE is imposed, are irrelevant.
But the court has held that that's illegal.
No, the court has never said you can't see what you can learn from the data from CARE. If CARE produces emissions at one level, EPA can say, we believe as a factual matter that deeper emissions cuts will make air quality worse. The court never said EPA has to blind itself to the facts of what air emissions data says today to suggest, as EPA does, that they were somehow forbidden. They had to put blinders on and say, we have to pretend that none of this data exists and we can produce data that's completely inconsistent with it. There's no such holding in CARE. And even if their projections were correct, we would still be faced with the problem that they project without CARE and without CASPER that nearly half the areas that they're forcing regulation because of would be in attainment even if there was no CARE or no CASPER, and there's no justification under the statute for that. If the court has no further questions.
All right, and I just want to be very clear. In your reply brief, if I go back and look at it carefully again, I will find this argument that this issue was properly preserved.
Page 6, note 1, reproduces Tennessee's comments. It also makes reference to the proposed rule on mentioning air quality only. What it may not do, I'd have to go back and check. I'm not sure whether we put in the footnote that CARE at 70 Fed Reg 25177 specifically addressed this issue as well. That's the one piece.
I have all kinds of markings in that footnote, and a reference to volume 70 is not there.
I acknowledge the omission then, and that's why I wasn't sure it was there. But it is.
Well, it's a pretty critical argument, isn't it?
That's right, and I wish I had put it in the brief instead of mentioning it here. But it is something. It is something that the agency addressed, and, you know, better wisdom for me come too late than not at all.
I hear you. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Professor.
You.
Mr. Lipschultz,
yes.
Is that where we are? Yes, Mr. Lipschultz.
Well, I do.
Could I ask you,
yes.
Because maybe I misrepresented by calling it modeling, and you said, well, your co-counsel is going to discuss that. But were you going to talk about the $500 cost
yes.
threshold?
Uh-huh.
Could you do that?
I will. And I'll try and be brief if you want me to talk about any more details, I would. Maybe I misspoke before, and if so, I apologize. I didn't mean to suggest that the petitioners never addressed the argument at all in comments. Clearly, they cited comments in the brief, and our response was that EPA had good policy reasons laid out in the record. Some of the interveners talked about it, and I'd refer the court to JA 2934 to 35 for the selecting the $500 sum level. And in general, the rationale was that is a level at which utilities are incentivized to run their emissions control equipment, and there hasn't been much pushback on that. The pushback that has been is that perhaps you could get environmental results that are acceptable in the petitioner's view for some of these states. You know, there's higher cost levels for some of the SO2 states, obviously, but for those that a $500 ton level is appropriate, petitioners suggest you could look below that and still get acceptable environmental results. And what I would urge the court to do is to look at the comments that they actually cite. They cite two comments. One is from an industry trade group, EWARG, and the other is from the Southern Company, which is a utility. The Southern Company comments address SO2 emissions, and if you look at the page that they cite to, I can give you a citation if it'd be helpful, but it's in their brief, and the page that they cite to has a chart. And charts has $500 a ton, $400 a ton, $300 a ton, $200, et cetera. And you will see what they say narratively is that comment shows that acceptable environmental results can be achieved for SO2 at levels below $500 a ton. If you look at what the chart actually says, though, even at $500 a ton, their own projections are showing residual non-attainment and maintenance problems, and so on. As you get cheaper. And so they're not saying there's no problem at lower levels. They're saying by their own analysis, there are still residual problems. It's just that they think that would be an acceptable degree of environmental problem. The UR comments are primarily addressed to a different issue, to NOx, but they're not even addressed to the question, or the policy reason why EPA chose $500 a ton for NOx, which is that's the point at which utilities are incentivized to run their emissions control equipment. It's addressed an entirely separate issue that petitioners aren't even raising in this case, which is that UARG's comments it's a complicated argument. It's not explained at all in petitioner's brief, but if you read the comments they cite to, it's talking about their technical analysis of the interplay between NOx emission reductions and SO2 emission reductions and why certain aspects of the way EPA analyzed that for the proposal was, in their view, not quite right. That's a very different issue than what they're suggesting here, which is that if you look at the $500 ton threshold in isolation, it's flawed. And the final thing I just want to say is, I think we have to remember the context, which is what we're talking about is Michigan and North Carolina's acceptance of a cost-effectiveness approach. And no one's challenging that either $500 a ton or $2,300 a ton is cost-effective. And I think that's an important sort of overview to all this, keep in mind. Mm-hmm. That's really the gist of what I wanted to say at this point.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Ray.
Yes, Your Honor.
Any questions? No? Are you ready to submit?
I'm sorry. Well, could I just make one point about the 110K6
yes,
point that
may.
Was raised in rebuttal? EPA did not disapprove SIPs in the transport rule. What EPA did within 110K6 was simply to correct the previously approvals to say that in light of the court's opinion in North Carolina, that was all the agency did with 110K6.
Well, maybe not petitioner's point, but I guess my point would be that C1 requires the administrator to make one of two findings, and the K6 isn't such a finding.
No, it's not, Your Honor, but Bear in mind, Your Honor,
saying in effect that the approved SIPs are inadequate, and that leads you to K-5, the SIP call.
No, Your Honor. What K-6 is saying, first of all, there was an initial failure, finding a failure to submit or disapproval, which is what led to the care FIPs in the first place. For every state, for each EPA to invoke K-6, there, it had issued a FIP for care. What C-1 says is that the EPA's obligation to promulgate a FIP exists once it's made either one of those findings, either a disapproval or a finding of failure to submit, unless the state, A, addresses the deficiency, and B, EPA approves a SIP. EPA did approve for some states, I think there's only 8 states, EPA actually approved care SIPs. But the first part of that was the court's decision in North Carolina makes very clear that the first condition, that the deficiency be addressed, was not met. So that's what EPA is saying in the 110K6 findings. They're saying that EPA's FIP authority was not extinguished by approval of the CARE SIPs because the CARE SIPs did not address the deficiency, as the court clearly made clear in North Carolina.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Galliteri, did you have anything you wish to add?
If I can just take 1 second.
All right.
Just simply to respond quickly to Mr. Keisler's analogy. As I explained and as we discussed in the brief, EPA did validate its model. It did validate that it worked. It did compare it against real-world data. So if we're talking about shiny cars and turning the ignition, what EPA found was that its car could drive to 7-Eleven. It was perfectly safe to assume that it would make it further down the street in 2012 to the Starbucks. Thank you.
That's it. All right, we will take the case under advisement. Thank you, counsel.
Good job. Nicely done.